From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. FDR and the New Deal, this week on Soundings. My guests are Alan Brinkley of Harvard University and William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Alan Brinkley is the author of Voices of Protest and America in the 20th Century, both published by Alfred Knopf. William Luchtenberg is the author of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal, published by Harper & Row, and In the Shadow of FDR, From Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan, published by Cornell University Press. Here is William Luchtenberg.
Well, we're talking about the time period since the inauguration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt on March 4th of 1933. Mm-hmm. Most historians would say that the New Deal comes to an end in one sense, in a creative sense, in 1938, although I believe Alan Brinkley would argue quite persuasively that the New Deal continues on beyond that time, and however modified a form, well on into the period of World War II. In another sense, of course, the New Deal hasn't ended even today, because it provides the basis for much of the Fair Deal program of Harry Truman, of the New Frontier of John Kennedy, of the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson, and even in the 1980s, there are figures in public life, notably Senator Paul Simon of Illinois and his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination, who continue to look back to the New Deal for inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Alan Brinkley, what is it that's special about this time period that Bill Luchtenberg has described that helps to create a sense of a governmental agenda that did not exist in that fashion before?
Well, several things. Certainly the most visible is the Great Depression and the crisis of capitalism that the Depression created, and the increasing pressures on government to do something about it that crested perhaps in 1932, early 1933, which coincided precisely with Franklin Roosevelt's inauguration. Beyond that, I think this is a period in which governments in industrial societies all over the world are beginning to come to terms with the very changed social and economic realities that advanced industrial societies confront, and the new pressures that those put on governments, with or without a depression. Now, the depression hastened the process, but I don't think created it out of the blue. So the New Deal is a kind of benchmark in that the depression makes events that in some ways might have happened anyway happen quicker, mm-hmm. but it isn't by itself the cause of the development of a more advanced state.
Bill Luchtenberg, who do we associate with this term, the New Deal? Obviously, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There are other people involved. Where does the inspiration come from for this sense of a national governmental agenda?
The agenda for the New Deal had been building, as Alan Brinkley was saying, over a long period of time, at least from the 1880s and 1890s in the late 19th century, and then at a quickening pace in the Progressive Era, and particularly in World War I, with the first effort at national mobilization of an economy. And all of these provide a basis for much that is to come in the 1930s. And yet at the same time, as Alan was just saying, the Great Depression is an enormous catalyst for the acceptance of those ideas. One has to realize what the situation was when on noon on March 4th of 1933, FDR comes into office. There are perhaps a third of the nation unemployed and many more underemployed. Someone came to the economist John Maynard Keynes and said, had there ever been anything before like the Great Depression? Hmm. And he said, yes. He said, it was called the Dark Ages, and it lasted 400 years. There was that sense of desperation, of fear, of panic. And on the very morning that FDR takes office, Richard Whitney, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, who incidentally before the decade is out, will go to prison, steps to the rostrum and announces that the New York Stock Exchange is closed down. And that is symbolic at a time of crashing banks, of depressed industry, of massive unemployment, of a turning over of the reins of decision making from Wall Street to Washington. Mm-hmm. So the scene is set for FDR when he's sworn into office.
Alan Brinkley, let me ask you to elaborate on Bill Luckenberg's comments. Again, we're talking about the New Deal and the notion of a national agenda. What is the particular spin that you are putting on this topic? What is it that you are saying that may not have been said before about the New Deal?
Well, if you're talking about my own work, it involves a somewhat different question, which is what happens later in the New Deal after most of the concrete accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration are in place, and at a time when the New Deal becomes politically less powerful and less successful. What happens to the idea of the state as it evolves through those later years after 1937, 1938, and through the war? And that raises a different question, I think, which is that the New Deal in its early years, say in 33 through 37, when it was really a very active and dynamic institution-building phenomenon, created a range of institutions, a range of laws, a range of initiatives, each of which could have become a prescription for a particular kind of state in mm-hmm. the future had they been further elaborated. Some of those initiatives survived as part of the agenda for liberals and people who believed in a strong central government in the years after World War II, and some of them did not survive as part of that prescription. And the question I've been trying to answer is, why did some survive and others not, or why did some survive more strongly than others?
Well, what did survive? What, for example, would you address specifically?
Well, I think there's several things that fit together into a perhaps not entirely coherent, but reasonably coherent vision of what the liberal state would be that survived the war and are strengthened by the war. One is the idea of the government using fiscal policies as a way of managing the economy, taxing, spending, what later would become known and what during the war was already becoming known as Keynesian economics. That was something that the New Deal had been doing inadvertently from the beginning, but something with which Roosevelt in particular had never felt very comfortable. In fact, in 1938, had actually, or in 1937, excuse me, had actually cut the budget in an effort to get the economy back on its own two feet and help precipitate a recession in the process. But beginning in 1938 and continuing through the war, the idea of fiscal policy and deficit spending in particular as a means to fight recession gained legitimacy quite steadily and quite powerfully through the war, so that by the end of the war, the idea of a full employment economy, which meant an economy that the government could manipulate by using its spending powers to promote higher levels of consumption and employment, had become legitimate in a way that at the beginning of the New Deal it had not. Along with that, the New Deal survives even today in the popular memory as the event that legitimized the idea of the welfare state. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of the welfare state in a somewhat narrower sense than sometimes the phrase is sometimes used to describe, which is a state that is committed to assisting people in need of assistance, Social Security, unemployment insurance, welfare, in later years, of course, healthcare insurance and other things. That, too, is something that emerged strengthened out of the New Deal. But then there are also a number of aspects of the early New Deal that did not emerge from the war, legitimized in quite the same way. And I think in particular of the various experiments in direct management of the economy. Regulatory managerial efforts by the government to tell corporations how to behave and become involved in decision making within the corporate world about various issues. Those kinds of initiatives did not survive the war with anything like the strength of the ones I've just described.
Mm-hmm. Bill Luckenberg?
Well, I think that one has to realize what the situation was before FDR took office, that the government had never, in peacetime, built a public housing project. that the government was not involved in subsidizing farmers.
And this was as late as what, the middle 1930s?
No, as late as FDR is elected in 1932, at the end of the Hoover regime, at the time that FDR takes over in 1933, when Roosevelt comes to power, almost no factory worker in America belongs to a union. By the time he leaves office, the major industries like auto and steel, rubber, textiles are all unionized, some to a greater degree than others, in part at least, because of government policies such as the Wagner Act. So that you have a range of activities on the part of the national government that had simply not been there before. In the 1930s, the government subsidized writers and artists, the ballet, the government even had its own circus.
Many people would tell you it still does.
Right, right. Even the notion of providing lunches, hot lunches for school children, that kind of intimate involvement of the national government with the American people, that really starts in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Before then, before FDR takes office, numbers of people have said that you'd hardly know there was a federal government. You saw the post office, although even most of the post offices that you see, or a great many of them, were built by WPA or PWA funds in the 1930s. So there's an enormous change that takes place. Mm-hmm. Most historians would say that almost everything important that happens in the New Deal happens in Roosevelt's first term. Social Security Act, TVA, all the things that we've been talking about, and that in 1937, a series of things go wrong for Roosevelt. He advances a plan to pack the Supreme Court, and though in the end he has his way with respect to the substance, that legislation is bottled up. It never is enacted. There are a series of sit-down strikes, particularly in the auto plants, that arouse alarm in middle-class America. And as Alan was just saying, there's a recession that takes place. Ironically, because Roosevelt, who has been attacked as a free spender, takes the advice seriously and tries to balance the budget, which at a time of depression is a very wrong thing to do. And in 1938, with the enactment of the Wages and Hours Law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the New Deal comes to an end. At least that has been the standard judgment. And what Alan is doing is saying, there's more to that story. We've got to press on and look at what happens in Roosevelt's second term, and indeed what happens in World War II. And he finds that there is considerably more to New Deal liberalism than most historians up to now have recognized or acknowledged.
Does this, Alan Brinkley, involve what, new methods? Does it involve new sources? You have a former president of the Organization of American Historians sitting at the other microphone. Tell me, what is it that's special, that's new? We might even use a dangerous word like unique. in what you were doing that, as Bill Luchtenberg has said, helps you to break some new ground.
What I'm trying to do is to show that precisely because the New Deal after 1937-38 has so little political strength domestically in terms of new innovations in social policy, that liberals within the New Deal and around the New Deal are forced to think seriously about what the New Deal means and what's going to come next. They can no longer sort of sit back and feel confident that they've really done it, that the Depression has been ended, as many people were coming to believe in early 1937. Now that the New Deal was in some political difficulty, now that the economy after 1937 seemed less secure than people had been trying to believe it was early before the recession, it became a time for liberals to start thinking seriously about what the New Deal actually meant and what was going to happen as in the future when they had another chance to build institutions and to do the kinds of things they'd been doing in 1933. What lessons should they draw from what they'd done in the first term? Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to tell is essentially an intellectual and ideological story, not a story of building, of passing new laws or building new institutions, but a story of what happens to ideas about government among liberals as they move through a period in which they really don't have very much opportunity to put those ideas into motion.
Mm-hmm. How does it go? The song may be over, but the melody lingers on for a while.
Sure.
Let's bring it up to, what, the late 1980s. What has the administration of Ronald Reagan done to or for or about the New Deal? Bill Luchtenberg, I remember you wrote a piece for the New Republic. You weren't particularly happy with the title that they gave it.
That's right.
was Reagan a conservative? Help me with that. Give me the specifics on that.
The title was Reagan's Secret Liberal Past.
Yes.
which jazzed up a bit what I'd said, but it had the essence of it, and it is a chapter, as you know, in my book, In the Shadow of FDR, from Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan. The interesting thing about Reagan is that he is thought of, and quite reasonably, as an antagonist of Roosevelt and the New Deal, and yet, in fact, he looks back very fondly toward the 1930s. He has a couple of different versions of that. One is that, yes, he voted for FDR in 1932, but it was the FDR who wanted to balance the budget and who pledged to do so in that campaign, and that thereafter the Democrats diverged from that, moved toward the kind of New Deal policies that Alan has been talking about, and that he broke with the New Deal. In fact, he voted for FDR not just in 1932, but in 1936 and 1940 and 1944, all four times. And he was, as he once described himself, a hemophiliac liberal, which goes a bleeding heart liberal even one step farther. Uh-huh. And to a number of interviewers, he has never denied that he has those fond memories of Roosevelt, and not just of the FDR, who was a national leader and a leader in foreign policy, but of the New Deal itself, of which Roosevelt was the chief architect, understandably, because the Reagan family survived in the 1930s, because Reagan's father was the head of the WPA, the relief works, we would say welfare program of the 1930s in the small town of Dixon in which Reagan was raised. Reagan has another view, though, which is that the New Deal was mimicking Mussolini's fascism. And somehow or other, he's able to hold both of those very different ideas in solution. He continues, I guess one would say in sum, to look back with admiration and Roosevelt the leader, while at the same time attempting to undo much of the tradition of government intervention in the economy, mm-hmm. particularly on behalf of the welfare of less fortunate Americans.
Alan Brinkley, tell me about the Reagan administration in terms of what an ideological inheritor of the New Deal. Elaborate on Bill Luchtenberg's remarks. Bill's been talking about Reagan's personal history, the way he appears to differ and yet squares in many ways with FDR. Help me with that.
Well, I'm not sure at this point it's possible to divine an ideological core to the Reagan administration. It seems to have
well, we're too close, is that it?
Well, partly because we're too close and partly because the administration seems to have moved in so many different directions at different times, and never more so than at the present. But I think there are certain ideological inheritances, you could say, that perhaps are no longer so clearly associated with the New Deal that they make the right wing feel uncomfortable, but nevertheless are very clearly a legacy of them. Supply-side economics is a kind of bastard child of New Deal economics in a way. The idea of managing the economy through using tax and spending policies. Now, as I say, it is a bastard child. It is hardly the way in which New Dealers, even at the time, would have chosen to do this. But the kinds of tools that the government tries to use today when it attempts to deal with economic problems are tools that were really first legitimized, first used and legitimized in the New Deal. When the stock market crashed in October of 87, and it seemed, at the moment at least, to portend very serious economic problems, and it is yet to be seen whether that in fact will be the case, On the one hand, Reagan came out and made some very Hooverish-sounding statements. Statements sounded very much like what Herbert Hoover said in the early and mid-years of the Depression, when he said that the fundamental basis of the economy is sound and so forth. On the other hand, it was very clear very quickly that the Reagan administration was not going to do the kinds of things that the Hoover administration did in response to the Depression, with things that had made the Depression much worse. It was not going to tighten credit. It was not going to raise taxes. Reagan did make some tentative commitments to raising taxes. But he was not going to adopt a deflationary approach to economic problems, and that's something that suggests, I think, that he has learned the same lesson that the New Dealers learned of the failure of the fiscal policies of the Hoover administration.
Mm-hmm. Bill Luckenberg.
I think one can add to what Alan has just said, that when Wall Street leaders were asked whether the stock market crash portended the possibility of a very serious recession, even something like the Great Depression of the 1930s, they said, oh no, that can't happen because we have agencies like the SEC, like a Federal Deposit Insurance for bank deposits. In short, all of the New Deal innovations that Wall Street so strongly resisted at the time and now sees as built-in stabilizers in the economy.
Uh-huh. Alan, frankly?
Well, I'd just go further and say that one of the reasons that the stock market crash, at least in the short run, has not had the sort of cataclysmic expanding effects that the crash in 1929 did is that because of the New Deal, because of the Securities and Exchange Commission and other regulations, people are not permitted any longer to speculate in stocks in the way they were in the 1920s. And so when the market crashed, there were many fewer people who were bankrupted because they had been so heavily marginalized in the stock market. Mm-hmm. The margin requirements are much higher. And you did hear occasionally of people who were ruined because they had bought on margin and couldn't cover the margin calls, but it was a very small number of people compared to what happened in 1929, when a large proportion of the economy, including much of the banking system, was virtually bankrupted because they had speculated so heavily in the stock market on at such high levels of margin.
Bill Luckenberg of the University of North Carolina and Alan Brinkley of Harvard University, let's conclude our conversation. Let me put you guys on the defensive a little bit. You're both professional historians. Do you think that the politicians listen to you? I mean, you may have friends in the administration or enemies in the administration, but to what extent does the practice of history today have anything at all to do with the reality of American politics? Is that a proposition that needs to be defended? Help me to understand it. Bill Luckenberg?
I wouldn't think so. I guess my most recent experience on this was in September when I, along with another historian, John Hope Franklin, and Walter Dellinger of Duke Law School, were asked to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of Robert Bork. Mm-hmm. And that appears to have been a new departure of asking historians in not merely members of the bar on an occasion of this sort. And I think historians have a constant sense of being called upon by figures in public life to present information or insights, interpretations. And one has a feeling, too, that the current generation of political contenders, people like Paul Simon, for example, are very well read in history. Simon himself is someone who has written an important book on Lincoln's preparation to greatness. And I think the divorce between the historical profession and men in public life is not nearly as great as some might think.
That's encouraging to hear. Alan, frankly?
Well, I think that's true, and there are other ways as well and that you can see the influence of historians. For example, more and more agencies of the federal government, the Senate of the United States, the Supreme Court of the United States, all now have historians of their own. They've hired to help them create and maintain an institutional history from which they can draw. It is as easy for decision makers to draw the wrong lessons from history as it is to draw the right lessons from history. And history is used often, but it's often misused. And there is a tendency, I think, for policymakers in particular, to search for those historical lessons that support what they want to do anyway, rather than to use it as a vehicle for testing their ideas against previous realities. So it isn't always an entirely good thing the way history is used, but I think on balance, and of course Bill and I both have a professional interest in saying this, but I think it nevertheless I believe it, that on balance it's a healthy thing to see people in public life attempting to make use of what scholars do.
And to follow up what Alan was saying, there are cautions, and one of the cautions would be the one that he's just stated about the ease with which men in public life, men and women in public life, might draw the wrong analogy. And I suppose the best example of that would be the use of the Munich analogy by the makers of foreign policy in Vietnam, something which disturbed a good many historians at the time and since. The other point, and I'm sure Alan would agree with this, is that though one welcomes this kind of relationship of historians to public policy, it's always very important for historians to maintain their own independence, not to be captured by policymakers, not to be captured by politicians, but always to look at events from the outside, from an independent posture, so that their judgments are in no way corrupted by power or by people with different agendas from those of scholars.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. My guests were Alan Brinkley of Harvard University and William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Alan Brinkley is the author of Voices of Protest and America in the 20th Century, both published by Alfred Knopf. William Luchtenberg is the author of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal, published by Harper and Row, and In the Shadow of FDR, From Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan, published by Cornell University Press. For a cassette copy of Soundings on FDR and the New Deal, send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 403. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about Karl Marx and Marxist philosophy in the 20th century. My guests will be Eugene Genovese of the University of Rochester and James Epstein of Vanderbilt University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
FDR and the New Deal, this week on Soundings. Alan Brinkley of Harvard University and William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill discussed the creation of the New Deal and its continuing importance in American politics. FDR and the New Deal. Listen for some answers and insights this week on Soundings.